This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the Best of Fight Back from the week that was. With finances so tight for so many, it's hard to imagine losing track of a sure thing. But that's what's happened to nearly 200,000 pension plan members who lost track of their plans. That number is from the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario, which figures there are $3 billion in associated benefits that are stranded because of this situation. Libby spoke about the issue with Kurt Rosentreter, Senior Financial Advisor and Portfolio Manager at Manulife Wealth.
I find that there's probably, as much as is in some cases people lose track of it with their employer, there's probably like five or six different examples that I can outline of when money goes missing, so to speak. You know, and just to kind of lay them out, in one case where, you know, the employer just says, no, sorry, you didn't work here. Like that can happen when, as you said, you can change employers a lot. And they disputed. Maybe, I think that's more common with smaller businesses where their records may not be as great, but it can happen. Two, you've got a bankrupt employer who effectively makes it even more challenging to get the information out related to your pension because now they're arguably gone and all the people are laid off. Three, if you take a leave of absence and you're gone for an extended period of time, that can create gaps in employment history that can make this more challenging. Four, job change. They say, research shows now we may have as many as six different careers by the time we retire and shut it down. So again, different pensions. And lastly, divorce and even financial hardship can cause differences in pensions that result in a lot of complexity that the average consumer may struggle with.
Can't people or couldn't people port their pension?
They can. So in a lot of cases, when you leave an employer, or even when you retire, the organization will engage often an actuarial firm that will determine whether or not, okay, A, do you want to keep your pension there and start to claim it, say it's 65. Two, do you want to keep your pension there and maybe take it early? Three, do you want to take it out and transfer to investment savings? And four, if you're going to another employer that has the same kind of pension, can you actually port it and integrate it into the new pension plan? So it's not uncommon when people leave their employer to see three, four, five, six different options that can be a bit overwhelming. I probably do one engagement a week where I'm helping someone sort through what the best options are for their personal circumstances.
And do people just forget that they have this pension from this company? Is that the problem?
Absolutely right. Like in most cases, the most common situation is people just forget where they worked 30 years later, 20 years later, 10 years later. They may not even remember they had a pension plan. And if they've moved and their address was never updated with the HR department, then they stop getting statements, which also, you know, takes this away from front of mind. When I do estate work after someone's died, And it even gets worse because you're dealing with a survivor who wasn't even the pension beneficiary. Now it's a spouse who has no clue where their partner worked 25 years ago, but may be entitled to spousal support benefits after their death. So it's really important that the public keep track of their employment history, the plans they were part of, and make sure the address is always up to date with the HR department. Let me give you one more extension of this. Yeah. Here's another dimension of this that, let's say you moved out of the country for a while and you went and worked in the States or in London, England for a few years. You may, you know, let's put pensions aside, you may qualify for their social security system because you worked there long enough to qualify for a pension check for the rest of your life, much like CPP. I run into that one all the time as well.
How long? I worked in the States for a while.
You no. have to meet their point system. So, but the U.S. Social Security is lucrative. So I ask everybody, did you ever work outside the country? And which countries? And some of these are pretty, you know, significant Social Security benefits. So it's not just pensions. It's really anything that you may have contributed to where you were.
Anything else that you want to tell people? How long a process should they expect? How much time do you have to put into this?
Well, I think before you retire, these are often issues related to retirement, right? You're looking for your pension. So I would say that a good 5 years before you retire, you should start to get organized on all of your you know, kind of retirement-based assets. So, for example, CPP, Canada Pension Plan, if you've paid into that, call Service Canada, order a history of your CPP benefits back to age 18, and just make sure it looks complete. If you see big gaps, like, okay, well, why is that? And you could talk to them about that. If you took time off for maternity leave, let's say, you may want to talk about whether or not you can be exempt from those years so that you're not getting penalized for it. For pension plans, it's no different. You want to look at your career history back to when we were all teenagers and say, where did I work? How long was I there? And is there an organization that I can go talk to see if I'm entitled to ask?
Kurt Rosentreter, Senior Financial Advisor and Portfolio Manager at Manulife Wealth. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. It's spring cleaning season, and trying to donate your unwanted stuff is a lot more challenging than it used to be. Libby shared a personal experience on Monday of a frustrating conversation with a chat bot on the phone while trying to rent a van to move stuff. That's where the conversation picked up with the Zoomer Squad. Daryl Bricker is CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. Anthony Quinn is Chief Community Officer of CARP, A New Vision of Aging. And Rudy Butignol is CARP's president.
Yeah, I had the same problem when I was clearing out my mom's house, trying to give up. She had really great furniture, but it wasn't the style that I was interested in, nor did I need it. And it was really hard to give it away. We finally went to a local neighborhood Facebook page and let people know, like, there's a great dining bedroom set, matching set for anyone that's willing to come and get it. But that was it was really hard. It was after we'd gone through a lot of different steps to try to give it away. First you think, oh, well, maybe we should try to sell it. Well, forget that, you know. And then you settle with anyone with a truck that's willing to come and take it. And fortunately, we found a good family for it. But it's really difficult because a lot of people, you know, younger people are in smaller places. They don't want their parents' furniture, their friends' furniture.
They don't like that heavy wood look.
Yeah. Who knows? You know, in 50 years' time, of course, they'll be looking for the next generation will be looking for something their grandparents had or their great-grandparents.
The other thing that I'm finding from people, including my husband and friends of ours, is that they want to know that their stuff is going to a good home.
And unfortunately, it's less likely to do that. There's an entire industry growing up around the GTA now for storage facilities where boomers are storing things that they want to keep, and they're paying high monthly bills to store these things. And it's a terrible investment because once they're gone, the stuff will disappear eventually anyways.
There's this relatively new industry, Daryl, of people picking up your, you know, junk. It's not necessarily junk, but suddenly we've gone from a place where you could actually sell things and make a few bucks where you have to pay.
Yeah, no, and I use them too. I mean, but around where I live, if you put something out in the front around garbage day, somebody comes up and picks it up and takes it by 2 a.m. anyway, so it tends to go away. But I mean, this is why, you know, they've got those shows like Swedish Death Cleaning and things of that nature. I mean, when you get older, you have to start thinking about, do you really want to stick your kids with having to deal with all of this stuff? Maybe you should deal with it. You probably have more time on your hands, and you know what will be really valuable. To your kids, maybe hold on to that, but this other stuff that you don't need, get rid of it.
My husband inherited furniture, and there was one particular piece that was very meaningful for him, and it was very awkward, but I would never have asked him to get rid of it. And suddenly, when an opportunity came up, he said, oh, I have no attachment to this. And I'm thinking, we've had this for 35 years, and I remember you having a big attachment to it. So people do change on that note.
It does. It's about life's change. I felt the same way when we were clearing out our house in Toronto to make a move to Vancouver. But we had a year's time to start putting things out on the curb, right? Oh. So we could put it on the curb. If you have the time to give it away, it works. But after a year of it, we still had all this other stuff. And the thing that I thought about is, why did we buy this in the first place? You know, half the things you look at, you think, why did I buy this? Now I've got to deal with it. And maybe it's our materialistic selves, you know, as you get older, you realize what's really valuable.
Are you getting rid of anything, Anthony?
I'm not, but I've gone through the process with my aging parents, and the conversation is important to have with the boomers and their adult children on what we're keeping, what we're not keeping, and the value, sentimental or otherwise, but the planning ahead for those downsizing times, very important.
Daryl, how about you?
Well, you know, it is interesting when you look at the what people actually do with downsizing. They actually don't downsize that much. There's this view that what happens is you retire and you get rid of your house and you move out. That's actually not what happens.
Right.
Most people stay right where they are. When you look at the data on this, it's also that's how where people feel comfortable. They feel satisfied. It's where they like to live. They're not doing it because they have to. They're doing it because they want to.
Daryl Bricker is CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. Anthony Quinn is Chief Community Officer of CARP, A New Vision of Aging. And Rudy Butignol is CARP's president. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, where is the security for high-profile political events? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. On Tuesday, we addressed the national embarrassment that happened a week ago, the canceled state dinner, which was supposed to be held at the Art Gallery of Ontario with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his Italian counterpart, Giorgia Meloni. Anti-Israeli protesters blocked the entrances at the AGO, and so it was decided the event would be canceled, although it remains unclear whether it was the Prime Minister's security detail or Toronto police who issued the cancellation. Libby discussed the situation with our recovering politicians. Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP, John Molloy, former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister, and Lisa Raitt, former deputy leader of the Federal Conservatives.
I'm looking at this from a very technical point of view because I do believe that the right to protest, the right to picket, is essentially what they were doing by being in front of the doors, is a fundamental right. It's been recognized by the court. However, it has to be guided by the rules of both criminal law and civil law. So I think it's good that the Toronto police are looking into it. The notion that the doors were being blocked concerns me greatly because what happens if there was a fire and somebody needed to get out? That is a safety concern that absolutely needs to be addressed. But here's the thing. When you're in a situation where a union is picketing a workplace, you know, there are rules. There's a picket captain that you can speak with. There's a respect and a rapport between the police force and what the picketers are attempting to do. Picketers are not allowed to defame people. They're not allowed to have signs that are personal in nature. Those rules are really clear, and you can see them on Unifor's website. But in this case, I mean, it's picketing, but it's pandemonium at the same time, Libby. And I think somebody has to bring some order and some rules around what's going on. And that's the police.
Generally speaking, you have to get a permit to protest. And I gather there was also a situation where the police wanted to arrest a woman. I forget exactly what she was doing, but a huge crowd gathered around them screaming, "Let her go," and they had to let her go. John Molloy.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that incident. I agree with a lot of what Lisa said about the fact that people have a right to protest. You know, it was the Prime Minister of Canada, the Prime Minister of Italy, and they were protesting the stand taken by those countries on an international situation. I mean, even if you disagree with them vehemently, I think I have a lot more sympathy with protesters going to confront politicians and protesters going to, you know, those horrible incidents of restaurants that are owned by Jewish individuals or institutions that have ties to the Jewish community. I mean, that's just pure anti-Semitism. So in a sense, the fact that they were protesting politicians, I say, well, that's fair game. But The question is, how was that? How was it allowed to get to the point where you actually had to cancel the event? And obviously, there's got to be a lot of people looking into this and you know, thinking through what are going to be the rules of the game for this sort of thing. Because unfortunately, the situation in the Middle East, it's, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going away soon, and we're going to continue to see these types of protests.
Well, and the protests are—they're increasingly intimidating.
Yeah, I mean, when do two heads of governments meet anywhere publicly that folk know about it that it isn't protested? So the real question is the exits and the safety of those concerned. It's kind of strange that, you know, the Toronto police are blaming the security team for Trudeau, and they're kind of doing the same, I've heard. So, I mean, maybe get together, guys and gals, and sort this out, because this is an international embarrassment, quite frankly, that we can't, that our prime minister can't have dinner with a foreign leader and not be able to get in the door. I mean, it's not like there were 10,000 people there either. From what I saw on the news there, there was a group for sure, but I mean, we have a police force for a reason, and Trudeau has a security team for a reason. So I think it's good that they're looking into it, because it should never have happened and should never happen again.
Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP, John Molloy, former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister, and Lisa Raitt, former deputy leader of the Federal Conservative Party. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. We know that much of the delays in our healthcare system are caused by a lack of nurses. And we've also discussed the problem of nurses' burnout and unhappiness with their working conditions and financial compensation. On Monday, Federal Health Minister Mark Holland announced the launch of a nursing retention toolkit designed to support nurses. What is in it, and will it be enough? To find out, Libby was joined by Dr. Doris Grinspun, Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario.
You have heard me speak before much, that retention is a key for recruitment. We have spoken about that. The issue with the report is that this is not new, and we have been speaking about this for a long time, Libby. The report does not include a plan, and the minister did not really announce any new funding to implement the actions that the report recommends. The reality, Libby, is that the report, for example, misses key other reports done nationally, like investing in Canada's nursing workforce post-pandemic, a call to action, which has very concrete actions released in 2022. That's not in the reference. The report doesn't include also amazing things that are happening, for example, in Ontario. The report was released at Trillium Healthcare, and Trillium Health, for example, is a best practice spotlight organization. We have over 1,500 such organizations that implement evidence-based practice.
What's Minister Holland's suggestion that you think is not a useful solution?
Well, everything that is suggested is good solutions. The thing is, at the base of it is funding for staffing, for workloads, for the initiatives that will bring forward equity, diversity, and inclusivity, which the report does mention, RNO's task force of EDI. But RNO is also doing already concrete things on EDI. We are doing in Ontario, for example, 1NP for 120 residents that we are doing with the government here. The report could benefit from best practices all over this country that are working. So more suggestions is great, but there is not much new on that. What we need is more funding and a plan of action that the federal government wants us to put in place that we are not doing.
How much money do you think you need from the federal government?
Well, I think the federal government, I was expecting yesterday, and I know that the federal government signed the agreements because I was there when Prime Minister Trudeau and Premier Ford signed the $3.1 billion. I was very honored to have been invited. So I know there is some money there that says for human resources, but nothing specific to nursing. So what I was very much hoping yesterday is that with launching the report, it will be a pot of $30 million that nursing can manage to put in place some of the items that the report is recommending, whether it is as pilots or whether it is as permanent programs across the country. You see, we don't have specific items that are recommended, do it across the country, and it will work better than what we are doing.
Obviously, the impediment to that is that healthcare is a provincial responsibility, jealously guarded. And Quebec certainly objects to any kind of national standard, and Alberta is a bit of an outlier as well.
The reality is that if we are talking about the toolkit, don't give me for cultural change an initiative from the U.S. that is in one hospital in this country. We have 1,500 of them. Right in Ontario, we have 800 of them that are delivering outcomes like nobody else. How can we ignore key initiatives that are working in this country and mention one from the U.S. that costs $500,000 a year? Like the report needed more consultation with the key leaders, key associations, key unions in this country so that it could have had all that is working, not only ideas from the U.S. or from other places.
Doris Grinspun, Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Sunny in Richmond Hill phoned about the results of the federal by-election in Durham, which ended in a win for the Conservative candidate, Jamil Javani.
I think this is a lot of noise. The total vote was 27%. And the guy won 55% of 27%. How magnanimous is that? How great is that? Half the people, or one quarter of the people, only voted. So this is a whole lot of blow up by the media, in my opinion. They're trying to make a sort of headline for this guy.
Paul in Brampton called during our segment on missing pensions, when financial advisor Kurt Rosentreter was our guest.
Yeah, I was with the local 506 of the Construction Laborers Union in early 80s. And then I left there to the Aerospace Union for about 2 years. That is no longer, I tried to track it down, they're no longer in existence. Yeah, I worked for Air King, a Lasco metal product company out of Philadelphia. So I don't know where those pensions are.
So, Paul, what I would suggest is you know, there's an organization that you can contact that Libby mentioned called the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario. And, you know, they've got a website. It's fsrao.ca. For consumers, they help to sort issues like this out related to pensions. They also govern, just for interesting sake, property and casualty insurance, mortgage brokering, all kinds of different services, but auto insurance. But for you, contacting them, you can literally on their website say, you know, help me to track whether or not even a defunct organization that's gone left assets behind. Because very often what happens is with pension assets, they're custodied, fancy word, they're custodied separate from the business. So if the business goes bankrupt, and you know, a good example where we saw this in recent years was Sears Canada. Sears Canada went bankrupt, but the pension fund's a standalone asset base that still ensures that the pensioners get payments. you know, hard to believe this would be any different with the aerospace one for you. And if they've got, you know, the records, they can dig into this. And the reality is pension funds have to file annual documents. So there is an audit trail that may be beyond just the average consumer digging into themselves. But the FSRA is built to really help and advocate on your behalf to sort this out.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Bernadette in Etobicoke, who phoned in during our segment on obesity.
I was 200 pounds heavier, and I've lost all that weight. You know, I started to go to some of the fat doctors in Toronto and, you know, lost a bit of weight with them, but I put that weight back on. I decided that I've got to take this into my own hands, that I'm not going to spend one more penny on weight loss. I'm going to do it on my own. And so I did.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at Fightback Libby and call our Fightback voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.